Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, the White House released a new report on climate change today that has bleak predictions for a future. We'll get the details from one of the study's lead authors.
First, we take a look at a new study that deals with the death penalty in the United States, and it draws attention to the plight of inmates who are falsely convicted.
According to the study, 4% of all defendants who have been sentenced to death and who remain under threat of execution are probably innocent, about 1 in 25 inmates on death row.
Joining us now is Samuel Gross. He's a professor of law at the University of Michigan and the lead author of the study. Samuel, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, you found that 4% of all defendants who've been sentenced to death and who remain under the threat of execution are probably innocent. How did you get to that number?
Well, we started with the number of people who had been sentenced to death in the period we studied, which is 1973 through 2004, who had been exonerated, which gives you some idea of the number who might be innocent, but is not going to give you a full picture because some of those people who are innocent who might be exonerated won't have had enough time to get exonerated, and some people who are innocent will never be discovered. And the question is how to focus the analysis to get the best estimate of the underlying rate of innocence from the limited number of exonerations that we know about. And the way that you did, a technique known as survival analysis, enabled us to do two things. First, to control for the fact that not all of the defendants who had been sentenced to death had been on death row long enough for the process of exoneration to work, because on average, those who were exonerated after being sentenced to death had served 10 years on death row before they were released. And second, to try to limit the fact that so many who had been sentenced to death who were innocent weren't exonerated and probably never would be. And for that second purpose, we focused on those exonerations that took place while the defendants were under threat of execution, because the reason for the very high rate of exonerations among people sentenced to death is that our system is correctly geared to be very concerned about the possibility of executing innocent people. So we put huge amounts of time and effort into reexamining cases of people who might still be executed. But then if they're removed from death row and resentenced to life imprisonment, which ultimately happens to most people who are sentenced to death, then we lose interest. Then the resources aren't there, the courts don't pay attention, and very few people are exonerated after they're removed from death row. So the question was, could we devise a method of focusing in on the rate of exoneration that is generated by that very high level of scrutiny that's applied to defendants who might still be executed. And that's what we were able to do, and that gives us as good an estimate of the underlying rate of innocence as we can get, given our ability to detect innocence after the fact, which is what these exonerations do.
And in a system where you want 0% margin of error, you're talking about life or death here, 4% seems high. Is that a conservative number, or is that a number that you feel is right on the money?
Well, it's an estimate, so I don't think you can say it's right on the money. Like most estimates of this sort, what it means is that the rate is somewhere between something like 2.8% and 5.4% or something like that. 4% is the most likely number, but given that it's an estimate with the type of uncertainty around it that we see all the time, and reports of opinion polls and things like that. I think it's a conservative estimate. That was our design, was to come up with a conservative estimate because of the nature of the issue. We didn't want to overstate what we could. And it is probably a conservative estimate because it doesn't take into account the exonerations that will never be found at the end of the day. Specifically, if people remain on death row for more than 21 years and are not exonerated in that entire period, they are a portion of those who are innocent that we do not account for.
As lead author of the study, what was your reaction when you hit that 4% estimate?
Well, I think this is a surprisingly high number. I wasn't surprised any time in the last few years. The study has taken a long time to complete, and we've been seeing the results sort of foreshadowed by earlier findings. But when I started working on this, which was about 15 years ago, I did not expect the rate to be anywhere near this high. I would have predicted 1% or 2%. I think it is a surprisingly high rate, yes.
Your study's gotten some criticism. People who have said that 4% is too high an estimate. You're saying conservative. Others are saying too high. And I want to read you a quote from a district attorney who spoke to the New York Times. And he said, "That is an astronomical figure. I would quit my job and become a Buddhist monk if it was one-fifth accurate." How do you respond to criticism like that?
Well, he should shave his head and buy a saffron robe. If it was one-fifth, if what he means by that is that he would quit his job if a fifth of the number of people who were exonerated that we know of were actually innocent, then that's not even mildly controversial. Most of the cases we talk about are not cases in which there's any doubt about the innocence of the people who were exonerated. About 13% of them are DNA cases. In a whole bunch of others, the real killers have been identified, and many of them have been convicted. And then there are cases which are controversial. But there are cases that are controversial on the other side, too. There are people who have been exonerated in many senses, but aren't on our list because they don't count as exonerated by our criteria. For example, a man in Texas by the name of Kerry Max Cook was sentenced to death not once but three times. While he was in prison, he was repeatedly raped and abused in ways that are really too depressing to even describe. Before his fourth death penalty trial, he was offered a deal to plead guilty to second-degree murder and be released because of the time he'd already served, which he took. And then about 3 months later, he was cleared by DNA testing that showed that he was not the person who committed the rape murder for which he'd been sentenced to death three times. He does not count as an exoneree for us because he pled guilty at the end of the day in order to go home. And there are several other people like that. Those are ones we know about, where the person is very likely innocent but not exonerated because either they were not released or they were released under a plea bargain that allowed them to go home but required them to plead guilty to a lesser offense. And then there are ones we don't know about. So, there are no doubt some people on the list who are guilty. We say that. On the other side, there are others that we don't list who are innocent. And as best we can tell, they no doubt outnumber the ones that are misclassified in the other direction. So Mr. Marquis is entitled to his opinions, but he's not entitled to his facts. He'd probably be more informative if he had read the study carefully before commenting on it, because we do address this question.
In light of the botched execution at the state of Oklahoma last week and the renewed national conversation around the death penalty and your study, what do you hope our justice system does with the findings of your study?
Well, the botched execution is very depressing, but deals with an entirely different issue. The rate of false convictions among death sentences has been known to be high for a long time. I had published an earlier study with Barbara O'Brien that comes up with not a reliable estimate the way this one does, but with a lower bound, a low estimate that the actual rate must exceed of 2.3%, because we had not yet developed this statistical method and applied it here. And that's already very high, and it's hard to see how it could be. It was hard for years to see how it could be anything other than higher than that. So that's a disturbing fact that should be taken into account in discussions of the death penalty. But I think the more important lesson from this study is not about the death penalty, but about false convictions in general. Most of the people who were sentenced to death but are innocent have not been exonerated and will not be executed. Most of them were people who were sentenced to life imprisonment in the first place, even though they were convicted of a capital crime, or people who were resentenced to life imprisonment after being sentenced to death and then basically forgotten about. And behind that, there is a much larger group of defendants who are convicted of murders but not capital murder or of other crimes who never get this sort of attention and never get the opportunity to be exonerated. That is one of the ironic benefits, if you want to call it that, of being under sentence of death. And those numbers must be many times larger than what we see here, because death sentences are a tiny fraction of the number of people who are sentenced to prison in the United States, on the order of, you know, a hundredth of 1% of all prison sentences.
Samuel, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Samuel Gross is a professor of law at the University of Michigan.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out how to use gender-based pronouns correctly.
First, the White House released a new report on climate change today, the third U.S. National Climate Assessment. The report has some bleak predictions for our future, including flooding, longer droughts, rising sea levels, and longer wildfire seasons.
One of the lead authors is with us to talk about the report and what we can do to prevent these dire predictions and adapt to the consequences. Catherine Hayhoe is with us. She's associate professor in the Public Administration Program and director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you.
Well, this new report is the third U.S. National Climate Assessment, and the headline this time seems to be climate change is already here. How big a shift is this from the last report?
There's a lot that we have known for a long time. We've known that climate is changing. We've known that human activities are the primary cause. And we've known that climate change affects all kinds of aspects of our life, from the food we grow to the air that our children breathe. But up until this point, we really haven't felt, as humans, let alone as scientists, that climate change is something that's right here. We felt like it's distant, that it's happening up in the poles to the people in the Arctic, or it's happening to our children or their children. Today, though, we know that climate change is already here, and it is affecting people living in the United States today.
And there were about 300 scientists in on this report. Was there general consensus around the main issues?
Yes, you need that many scientists because climate change affects so many different aspects of our life, our society, and our environment. So there are chapters for each different region in the United States talking about the different ways that we're vulnerable to a changing climate, depending on whether we live in the Midwest or the Northeast or the South. Then there's different chapters on sectors like water and energy and transportation and the natural environment, all of the things that are important to us in our lives today.
And the report this time seems to have two strands going on, mitigating and adapting. Can you take us through those two aspects and what it says?
Those are really the two choices we have, or actually, as John Holdren, the President's Science Advisor, said wisely, we can mitigate, we can adapt, or we can suffer. It's a choice of how much we're going to do of each depends on the decisions that we make today. Mitigation means reducing our dependence on coal and gas and oil and transitioning in a sensible and sustainable way to non-carbon producing sources of energy and more efficient ways of using our energy. So that's mitigation. Adaptation means climate is already changing, and some amount of change is inevitable even if we make the best decisions in the world today. So we need to prepare for that change. Otherwise, it's like driving down a road looking in your rearview mirror instead of looking forward, planning for the future.
So are mitigation and adaptation at odds at all? Are they competing for, you know, the same resources, or are these two things that work in tandem?
We need to do both. We do not have the luxury of choosing between them anymore. Adaptation is undertaken primarily at the local scale, because the ways in which we are vulnerable to climate change vary depending on where we live. The vulnerabilities we've already built into our system determine how climate change will affect us. So just to give you an example, if you live on the coast, then you care about climate change because it affects sea level and it affects coastal storms. But if you live 100 miles inland from the coast, then what might matter to you are heavy rainfall events or heat waves. So the ways that we're vulnerable are part of the weakness of almost the Achilles heels that we've already built into our system.
The fossil fuel lobby has been trying to make the case against human-caused climate change for a while. Is that resistance to what's largely unanimous scientific agreement on the reality of climate change, is that still active? Is that part of this debate or this conversation?
It unfortunately is, because as long as there are parties who stand to gain and lose from doing something about climate change, there will be people arguing both sides. And the truth is that we need to stop using so much coal and gas and oil. But I've worked with awesome, amazing colleagues in the fossil fuel industry for years now. One of my first internships in grad school was with ExxonMobil. And I know that they have people there who know exactly what's going on with climate and know exactly what they're going to do about it as soon as they get the signal.
And, well, there was an executive from Chevron on this report as well, for instance, too.
Yes, exactly. That shows how this really is an issue that stretches across every aspect of our economy and our society, including the business sector, as well as including the public sector and other aspects of the private sector.
I want to get to some of the specifics of what the report forecasts in terms of climate change. It used to be called global warming, and we just assumed that the Earth was heating up, but now it's sort of more about erratic weather and climate changes that are different in all different parts of the globe. What does it say? What does the report predict about what we'll see in terms of climate change?
That's a great question. We scientists have called it climate change pretty much all along. It isn't some new term. But we're starting to make sure that other people realize that it's not just about global warming. Because, you know, honestly, for you and me, if the globe warms by 1.5 degrees, almost as it has, do we even notice 1.5 degrees? I mean, if you went from the room you're in into the room next door, it's probably 1.5 degrees different between the two rooms. So as individuals, we don't notice global temperature change. We notice a change in climate. Climate is the average conditions around us. It's how wet we expect it to be, how often we need to water our flowers, what types of food we can grow in our local gardens, whether we need winter boots or whether we can get by with regular shoes. This is what our climate is. And that is what is changing right here in the places where we live.
And some of the things that we're looking at now are, you know, a wildfire season that is longer and more intense in the Midwest, maybe flooding and longer droughts. What sorts of weather, you know, will affect the way that life runs in the United States?
Mm-hmm. A lot of the ways that we as individuals are experiencing a changing climate is through the changing risks of certain types of extreme weather. Specifically, heavy precipitation, which include both snow and rain events, a risk of flooding in some areas, heat waves, and the intensity of hurricanes and coastal storms. This is how you and I, or people, you know, living anywhere, might see climate change. And that's why, in addition to this national assessment, which is the most comprehensive, up-to-date, and plain text document we have, written not to scientists, but written to every person who wants to know about this, in addition to this report, we also have other amazing resources like the Years of Living Dangerously, which is a series that's running on Showtime right now. You don't have to have Showtime to get it, though. I know Showtime's kind of expensive, at least in our house. If you go to YouTube, they have a channel there where they have entire episodes and many short videos posted where they have gone around the United States and to some other places around the world, and they've actually documented the impacts of climate change. They have Arnold Schwarzenegger talking to firefighters in the West. They came down here to talk about the Texas drought. They go up into Greenland to look at oil drilling off the coast of Greenland. They put a human face on this problem.
Well, it's an interesting thing because there's a new Pew survey out that says that Americans, compared with much of the rest of the world, think that climate change is a less dire problem. 40% is kind of on the low end compared to lots of other countries, including Germany and Australia and England and, you know, like a huge list of other countries who are more concerned than Americans are. Why are Americans less concerned?
I think there's several different reasons. One reason is that other countries have experienced firsthand the impacts of climate change much earlier. In Europe in 2003, they had a massive heat wave that killed 70,000 people. That's not 70. And scientists did the number crunching and found that the risk of that heat wave had already doubled because of climate change. In Australia, they have gone through massive wildfire and drought seasons exactly as scientists predicted would happen because of climate change. Here in the U.S., in the lower 48, it isn't really until the last couple of years that we've seen anything we can point to other than the flowers in our backyard blooming earlier, which is not exactly anything to make us worried.
And I'm going to have to hit pause there, Catherine. We'll come back and keep talking about that as we talk about the new climate change report issued today. Talking with Catherine Hayhoe of Texas Tech University now about this new report issued by the White House today.
And we want to know what you think, what questions you have. Are you surprised by these predictions? What do you want to see change in the way we live and our economy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We'll pick up the conversation after the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrack.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're keeping on now with our discussion about a new climate change report out with one of its lead authors, Catherine Hayhoe of Texas Tech University.
And we want to know what you think about this new report. Are you surprised about some of the dire predictions, the findings that climate change is already affecting the United States? Do you worry about this? What do you think should be done to prevent things from happening? If anything, are you personally doing anything to help prevent climate change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
And Catherine, I apologize for jumping in on you before the news there. We were talking about how 40% of Americans think that climate change will have dire consequences, seemingly less concerned than lots of other people in other nations. And you were talking a little bit about why. Did you want to finish your thought there?
Sure. I was saying that one reason is that other nations have actually seen things happening before we have. But another reason is that we often think of climate change as just one more thing to add to the list of things that we already care about. And so if it's number 10 or 12 or 18 or 32 on our list, there's a lot of other things that take priority in our lives. Here's the difference, though. What we're finding as scientists is that climate change isn't a separate issue on the list. Climate change affects the things we already care about that are on our top 10 list. They affect our jobs, the economy, our health, our kids' health, the safety and security of our community, and even of the nation as a whole.
Now, your reference that this report is something that is written in plain spoken language. It's meant to be accessible to the layperson. And White House Counselor John Podesta has said this is actionable science. What kind of action do the authors want? What are you hoping to see from this?
The report illustrates very clearly that the choices that we make today have a huge impact on where we're going to be in the future. So whether we continue on our current pathway, status quo, depending on coal and gas and oil for most of our energy, or whether we transition in a sustainable, sensible way to new sources of energy, more efficient ways of using them, those decisions make an enormous difference on the impacts that we will experience.
And we want to go to the phones right now. We've got a lot of people waiting to talk to you, and we're going to start with Karen in Cottage Grove. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Veronica and guest. I have a question about how your guest feels politics fits into the equation. You had a guest on Central Time a couple of weeks ago that was talking about the fact that, you know, scientists obviously have done the research on climate change and the technology is there to implement renewable energy. In fact, he was saying that 50% of Germany's energy is now generated by wind and solar. And I'm wondering how politics in the U.S., particularly since the Citizens United decision, which basically has allowed corporations the right to give unlimited money into the political system, how your guest feels that might be affecting how things are going for our country.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Karen, for the call. Appreciate that. And Karen, referring back to Bill McKibben, noted environmentalist, who was on talking about how other countries are doing just fine implementing green energy or sort of going gangbusters with, given the example of Germany and looking at that, but also the effects of political money in terms of how it's affecting climate change. What do you think?
That is a fantastic question, Karen. In fact, I'm an atmospheric scientist by training, but I actually changed departments a couple years ago, and I'm now in a political science department because I believe that we could do the best science in the world, but if it is not getting through to inform good policy, what's the point? And right now, the science is there. This report is only the most recent in a long line of reports telling us basically the same thing, that it matters and we need to do something. The stagnant issue here is the politics. And part of that is because there isn't one silver bullet that solves the whole problem. There's lots of different ways to go about this, and which solution we pick is really a political issue, not a scientific one.
Karen, thanks a lot for the call. And we're going to move next to Edwin in Four Corners. Hi, Edwin.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. In terms of doing something, according to the IPCC report, the United States would have to reduce its carbon footprint by 90% by the year 2050. And I looked into that. That would mean if we got rid of all of our coal plants, we would get to about 40% reduction in our carbon footprint. And then if everyone became a vegetarian, we'd get another maybe 30% reduction. So that would be 70%. How do we get to the other 20? What sort of things are you trying to impose upon us to reach that? IPCC says 90% if we're going to survive the end of the world. So I'd just like to hear your guest comments on what she really means by doing something.
Okay, thanks a lot, Edwin. And Edwin outlining some pretty drastic stages or changes that need to be made to reduce emissions and combat climate change. What would you say to that, Catherine?
I would say, first of all, we are scientists. We are not trying to impose solutions on people. We're like doctors, where doctors do a scan of your body, diagnose the problem, and say, look, you have a problem and you need to do something about this problem. But if you go to a good doctor, the doctor's not going to, like, pin you down and shove pills down your throat. That's just inappropriate as a doctor. And so as climate scientists, we're the doctors of the planet. We've done the scan, and we are saying there is a problem. We are presenting all the information that we can gather from not just years but decades of research to try to inform good decisions by the democratic process. So I think that's a very important distinction. Second of all, there is a lot of gains that we can be make through efficiency. We are one of the most wasteful countries in the world in terms of how much energy we literally throw away. I mean, our old incandescent light bulbs waste almost 90% of the energy going into them. Replacing it with a new LED brings our efficiency and our energy bill down at the same time. So there's a lot that we can gain by simply being smart with the energy that we already have.
Okay, and thank you so much for that call. And we'll move next to Jim joining us from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I think that the climate is always changing. We've seen major changes in the past that were, you know, when we flourished the most, when carbon dioxide levels were multiples of where it is now. There was some recent research looking into the computer models that are used to, you know, form the famous hockey stick graph of climate change, and they found that those programs would come up with that no matter what you put into them. They were designed to put out a hockey stick graph. The research is being looked at very selectively. The stuff that supports what they say is accepted, and people that come up with contrary opinions, including many, many very important climatologists and physicists and other scientists, are ignored or discredited. You want to look at where the political money is coming into this. Look at the big banks who are going to make trillions on carbon credits out, making money from everybody for nothing.
All right. Thank you for your thoughts, Jim. And Jim's got some doubts.
I understand those doubts. I live in Texas, and I hear them all the time. Those are really good questions. But what I want to say to Jim and anybody else who has those questions is there are answers to those questions. If you go online and you have any questions about the science of climate change, go to skepticalscience.com. The answers are there, and it's not trust me answers. It's answers with actual data and scientific journal publications. You can dig as deep as you want into the science. If you want solutions, go to the National Academy of Science. Look at their America's Climate Choices reports. There is good information out there to answer these questions, and people deserve answers to these questions. That's why in the National Climate Assessment, my favorite section is the Frequently Asked Questions section. It answers questions that we hear all the time as people. How do we know climate is changing? Why do we think it isn't just some natural cycle like we've always had before? Why do we think this is something that we need to do anything about? Why don't we just ride it out? These questions are in the Frequently Asked Questions of the National Climate Assessment because these are the questions we're asking and we need answers.
All right, and thank you for that call. And as we kind of wrap up here, Catherine, one question has been how the White House is going to use this new climate change report. The White House is planning to release some carbon emission rules, some new rules there, and we're wondering if this report will be used in tandem there. And President Obama has also said that he's going to be focusing on using some of his remaining time in office to help fight climate change, to champion green energy, maybe using executive orders. How do you see this report fitting in with President Obama's agenda on the environment and climate change?
Well, this report is actually part of a process that was set into stone and set into law in 1990. So that's how long this process of issuing national assessments has been going on. But as a scientist, I think speaking on behalf of my fellow scientists, we are trying to and we are committed to providing the best available and most up-to-date information on what we know about climate and how it's going to affect us here living in the United States. And our hope is that this will be used to make sound decisions for our future and for our children's future.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Catherine Hayhoe, Associate Professor in the Public Administration Program and Director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University.
Most of us grew up learning and using the traditional pronouns, he and she. But not everyone feels that these gender-based pronouns fit who they are, their true gender identity. There's a new movement out there trying to give people more options, more flexibility.
Joining us here in the studio is Ryan Otsarius, a research associate in Wisconsin's Equity and Inclusion Laboratory. Thanks for joining us today, Ryan.
Thank you. This is really exciting to be here.
So, Ryan, besides these traditional gender-based pronouns, the ones a lot of us grew up with, he and she, which other pronouns are starting to crest to get used?
Well, I think there's two big categories. One of them is to use plural pronouns, so they and them or theirs. Or there's also a category that uses the pronouns Z and here. Z is typically used. It's one of the more difficult ones for people to use because it is very different from the ones that we typically encounter. But I think a lot of folks who I've encountered tend to feel more comfortable using the pronouns they, their, and them because it's a little more natural seeming, even though it is plural.
Well, this is our weekly Teach Me What You Know segment, and I guess teach us how we approach using these different pronouns. How do we make that contact with someone to know what they prefer?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So sometimes it can be a little ambiguous, and you might think, this person might not use the typical pronouns that we all grew up using. But it's usually not a great idea to say, I think there's something a little bit different here. Do you use X, Y, or Z pronouns? Typically, the way to go about discovering that about someone else is to put it on yourself. So if I were introducing myself to someone new, or if I was in a meeting or a classroom or some context like that, I would say, hi, everyone, my name is Ryan, and I use the pronouns he and him, and then try to model that for everyone else and get other people to do the same thing. And that makes it a little more neutral and everybody sharing instead of just singling one person out and asking them to indicate a difference.
You know, it's interesting because we are locked into certain conceptions about what gender is based on language, which is, you know, hundreds, thousands of years old. How do we go about, you know, changing the language? And can you make the case for why it's needed?
Well, I guess the case for why it's needed is that it kind of goes down to the point that gender, just like a lot of other social categories, are a social construct. There's nothing necessarily natural about it. Biology, of course, is something that there's chromosomal and DNA issues inherent with that, but the kinds of words and values that we associate with differences in biology are still social constructs. So allowing people to kind of identify themselves and giving rise to a language for them to do that is really part of the larger movement to allowing people to be more self-expressive rather than just commanding these are the way things are and you need to fit into one end of the binary or the other.
So these new alternative gender pronouns, they're fairly new to me, smack dab in the middle of a big university town. How widespread are these in the culture at large?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. Trans issues, I guess, if you look at the broad history of the lesbian and gay rights movement, it really started out with lesbians and gay men, and more recently, issues around transgender issues have come to the fore. And so it's one of those identity categorizations that is, it's emergent. There's not necessarily a large contingent of folks who have historically been out about their gender identity or their expression, but that's definitely changing. And I think if you see, there's a lot of documentaries in particular that have come up over the past decade or so, I'd say, which is really addressing issues of transgender folks in all different areas of the country, be it rural areas, big cities, suburbia. So I think it's something that we'll probably start seeing a lot more of as time goes on.
And can you walk us through, you walked us some examples in the beginning, but in terms of ones that may not come as naturally to people speaking Z or here, could you just let us hear how it sounds in the language if we're talking in conversation, some examples.
Sure. So going with the Z and here example, I would say something like, oh, the other night I was at Ben's house and Z said that here mom was going after them for having a messy room, for example. The other one that can be a little more complex for people to use just off the bat. The other one, like I said, that's a little more natural is using the plural pronouns. So using the same example, I would say, I was over at Ben's house the other night and they said that their mom was going after them for having a messy room.
It's tricky in both ways because they and there, a lot of people resist that just because it's not quite grammatically right if you're talking about one person. But then people might not necessarily embrace new words as a central part of their speech, the Z in here. How do you sell taking on this new thing one way or the other?
I guess I don't even think that selling it is the thing that necessarily needs to happen. I think using it. Mm-hmm. I think the more we use these kinds of pronouns or any new language, the more natural it becomes. And one of the challenges is, you know, with the emergent community that is out about their gender identity and their expression, it's going to take a while to kind of create a critical mass, for lack of a better word, to really see these pronouns being used more frequently.
One that I've heard recently that's not on the sheets that you gave us already is cisgender. What does that mean?
So cisgender is it's a construct of a way of conceiving of people whose gender identity and their expression and is aligned with their biological sex. So if somebody is biologically male, in our culture we've assigned certain identities, personality types, ways of dressing, acting, thinking to men. And so we would say that a person would who takes on those qualities and takes on those identities is cisgender. So their gender matches their biological sex that's given at birth. So I, for example, would identify as cisgender.
And where does the cis part come from?
Cis is a Latin word that means the same as.
Oh, okay.
And the concept there is if we have a specific word, say, for transgender and everything else, but not one for someone in that role, there's an assumption that it doesn't have a name because it's the norm. It's normal.
Exactly. Yep. And I think cisgender that's another one of those things with this emergent idea of transgender rights and transgender community resistance that is taking time for that to come up and become, again, for lack of a better word, normalized for people to identify with. But I mean, even in the 10 years that I've been involved with social justice and that kind of work, I've seen that word definitely come to the fore and be more of an identity category that people kind of take on and identify themselves as.
Have you seen these words starting to take off in literature and also maybe just in papers on college campuses? Or is it accepted?
Boy, that is a great question. I guess, you know, I haven't seen it in quote-unquote mainstream publications. It's definitely something that's used a lot on blogs and on the internet, so more alternative media. And yeah, I have a degree in gender and women's studies, and I can't say that I ever read a paper that used those terms without being about that kind of being about the issue. Yeah.
Huh. I suppose someone out there is on board. They've adopted the different pronouns. How about the awkward situation where they want to correct someone who's doing something different? Do you have advice on how to politely try to promote these?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really great question and really key. So I think the best way of going about that is for other folks who aren't necessarily trans identified to help one another out. So if I knew that, you know, my friend used a different pronoun set and somebody was still referring to them using a different gender identity pronoun category, maybe not necessarily right there at that moment is the best time to say, hey, my friend uses these other terms, but rather afterwards or in another more neutral context to say, you know, I heard you using she when referring to that person, and I think that they use these other pronouns. Or, for example, if I were to accidentally use the incorrect pronoun, the best thing to do is not to make a big scene of it or make you the center of attention, but to say, oh boy, I'm sorry. I know you use these different pronouns and I'll try to do better next time.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us today.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking to Ryan Otsarius, Research Associate in Wisconsin's Equity and Inclusion Laboratory, talking about new gender pronouns that are more inclusive and give people more options in how they identify.
Part of our Teach Me What You Know series. Next week, we'll learn how to run better. It's spring. We're going to try to run faster, more efficiently, more economically. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.